I'm Jessica Harris, and welcome to my welcome table. I'm going to be that the welcome table. Gather round this special table. It's scarred with memories, pitted with burn spots from hot skillets, and decorated with moisture rings from frosty glasses of lemonade, beer bottles, bourbon and ginger ale, and untold goblets of red wine. This table will be our flying carpet as we travel around the world. I'll share some of my secret spots. We'll meet new friends and reconnect with old ones. Sometimes, the table will be covered with fine Porthot linen and my mother's bone china, and we'll sup on caviar and champagne. Other times, we'll cover it with yesterday's news and hanker down for a crawfish boil or a lobster supper. Whatever the meal, by the end of our time together, we'll have shared some special friends, sacred spots, and the food, drink, and music that connects them. So come, join me at my welcome table.
Hi, I'm Karen Frericks. I'm sitting at the welcome table.
Hello, my name is Richard Alleman, and I am sitting at the welcome table.
I'm Jim Morgan, and I'm sitting at the welcome table.
I'm Bruce Kingsley. I'm sitting at the welcome table, and I'm thinking about the 70s.
I'm Tony Newfield, and I'm sitting at the welcome table.
My name is Scott Barton, and I'm sitting at the welcome table.
Compass point, 40.44 degrees north, 74 degrees west, Greenwich Village, time traveling. That Girl was a sitcom with Marlo Thomas that ran on television from 1966 to 1971. In it, the young Anne Marie had migrated from Brewster, New York to Manhattan to become an actress. My migration was made via subway. I came from Queens, but the cultural distance was perhaps even greater. It mattered little at the time because when I graduated from college, and it was time to leave my house, my parents' house, that is, I went off to have my own That Girl moment. I headed into Manhattan. I didn't know where to head, but my friends who were doing similar things ended up on the West Side or in Harlem. For some reason that I can no longer remember, I choose Greenwich Village to roost, and the village will always be a part of who I am. My first roost in the village was at 6 Charles Street, in a building that my father recognized immediately as an old line tenement house. But I had a full-time job teaching in a college, and so instead of tub-in-kitsch bohemia, I became the first tenant in a newly renovated one-bedroom apartment, complete with a brick wall that was then the true testimonial to my attempts at unconventionality. Well, it wasn't quite that simple. In fact, it only occurred after visiting a number of city agencies threatening to sue the management for discrimination and finally getting a lease. But then, I moved from my parental digs in Queens into the village in the early 70s. The village into which I moved was a place in transition. Beatnik bohemia had clearly ended, and the East Village was still enjoying the autumnal twilight of the summer of love. There were flowing garments aplenty in the restaurants for exploring with old friends from high school and newly made village friends seemed legion. On 8th Street, tucked in away among the bookstores like Brentano's, where I continued the book collection that is currently running out of the door of my house, and record shops where I indulged in my penchant for folkways albums, we're talking vinyl here, of Baroque music with crumb horns and tambourines and other musical oddments, or listened to things like Misa Luba, Misa Criolla, and developed a taste for what was later be known as world music, I continued to grow all of my things. My collection of Nina Simone music, Aretha Franklin's records, and more. The village was wonderful. Indeed, it was a time to be young, gifted, and black, in the 70s, in the village, where a different world was coming together. The village then was not as antiseptic as it is today. There's plenty of grit around the edges.
Hey, fourth floor! Hey, four! Four! Dorothy?
There's a garden there today, but then, at the corner of 8th Street and 6th Avenue, and trust me, it will never be Avenue of the Americas to any New Yorker, the woman's house of detention towered ominously over the intersection. And if I opened my bedroom windows on a summer night, I could hear folks calling up to friends and lovers on various floors of the spot where Angela Davis had been held only a few years earlier. But out of that same window, I could also sniff the smells wafting up from nearby restaurants. There was Mexican from El Charro downstairs, and perhaps a hint of oregano from the Italian spot around the corner. If I listened closely, I could hear the clink of glasses from the Ninth Circle Steakhouse and the rumor of conversation from Casey's one block over. I reveled in the village's restaurants and sampled from what seemed to be a world of cuisines in that era when arugula was still rare and strange, and menus needed to make notes to describe sangria. I can still hear the clank of my stilettos on the metal stairs as I climbed up to Shohi on 8th Street amid the bookstores and record shops. There, I served my Japanese food apprenticeship, beginning with tempura and moving up through sukiyaki to sushi. If I was on 8th Street, I was usually hauling a shopping bag from a bookstore, a record store, or from a Zuma, the wondrous bazaar of international oddities and objects that invariably tempted me. Fred Layton tempted me, too, with its gorgeous Mexican wedding dresses and frothy white laces, and wonderful, wonderful collection of ethnic jewelry. This was before the uptown move to Madison Avenue, when Fred Layton started selling serious antique jewelry and becoming purveyor to the Oscar A-list. But I couldn't afford it then any more than I can afford it now. I still liked the restaurants, though. Closer to home, one of my favorites was Angelina's, where I'd get to eat every time my parents visited, which was often, as they soon discovered and fell in love with the village as well as I had. In the 70s, the village was still a northern outpost of Little Italy, and there were numerous small mom-and-pop or nonna-run restaurants. Angelina's was one of them. A few doors down from my apartment around the corner on Greenwich Avenue, it was down two steps and into a long, narrow dining room where Angelina presided. Tiny, slightly wizened, but very wise and very welcoming, she greeted customers and watched over the restaurant that bore her name, as she no doubt watched over her family. And there, red Italian sauce was the order of the day. The Italian presence was also evident in the local greengrocers in that period before Korean markets began to dominate the New York landscape. Then, my market was Balducci's. Located at the foot of Greenwich Avenue, it was a convenient stop on the way home from the subway. It was there that I discovered arugula and broccoli rabe, and other vegetables that were exotic indeed. I also made friends with old man Balducci, who was a presence in the shop. Hovering and organizing, he was always there. I'd invariably be surprised to get home and find an orange or two slipped into my French string shopping bag. He did it. I guess he was curious about the young black girl living that girl life in the village. I saw him regularly, because it was my Julia Child period as well. I cooked, and I was fairly fearless. I remember coq au vin was one of my entertaining specialties. On one memorable occasion, when there were no pearl onions to be found, I simply substituted, Lord knows why, black-eyed peas. Coco black-eyed peas? Coco aux yeux noirs? It was, in the words of one of my guests, interesting. But they ate it and came back for more. And so it was another apprenticeship. And as I cooked, I got better. And as I got better, I got more self-assured. On many a Sunday, my folks would cross the bridge or take the tunnel and spend it with me. I'm an only child. They had nowhere else to go. We'd invariably end up at Sutter's, the pâtisserie that anchored Greenwich Avenue and was a meeting place for all. The pastry was sublime. I remember the croissant as flaky and buttery as those from Paris, and also sitting in the window, because there it was possible to watch the world go by. I even remember a perfect stranger coming up, knocking on the window, coming around, introducing herself to me and my parents, and saying, "I just wanted to meet you. You're such a lovely-looking black family." She's become a lifelong friend. If my parents didn't make it in, I usually headed out to other spots with friends. Then, Sunday was not fueled with coffee and conversation, but rather with Bloody Marys and jazz at a spot called Boomers on Bleecker Street. I'm not sure how to describe Boomers. In brief, it was an uptown spot in a downtown location. Slightly upscale, an open room with live music and great bar, it rapidly had become the haunt of musicians, actors, and general bohemia. My Charles Street days lasted 3 years. Then I headed further west. This time I hit the That Girl Motherlode of an apartment. It was a fourth floor walk-up in a small building and came complete with skylight, quirky floor plan, and three working fireplaces. By then I was a villager and knew my way around. As is often the case in many parts of the village, there was a restaurant downstairs. This time, it was the venerable Corner Bistro that was, and still is, home to one of the best burgers in New York. My new Western West Village was a whole different experience. There were other restaurants to be explored and new shops and places to visit. Here, my standby restaurant became El Faro. It was tucked away on Horatio Street at the edge of what has since become the meatpacking district. Then, there was meat, there were rats, and not much else. Rumor had it El Faro was the oldest Spanish restaurant in New York. I'm not sure that that's true, but I know that the owners and waiters were all from Galicia in northwestern Spain. As the waiters saved up and moved on, they took recipes and ideas with them. The lobster and green sauce might be the same, and the gambas al ajillo might be equally garlicky. But no one, absolutely no one, did caldo gallego like El Faro's. Caldo gallego is a rich, dense soup, almost a stew. It was thick with chorizo and strips of collard greens, white beans, and potatoes, and I'd make a meal of two orders of soup and some sautéed chorizo and olives that served as an appetizer.
pasó? ¿Qué me decís del Rioja?
A mí también me gusta, me gusta. Usted sí que sabe.
A mí me gusta el pim, 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 pim.
Y a mí también.
De la montaña, para pam, pam, pam. Vivir contento, pim, 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 pim. Cantar siempre, cantar para pam, pam, pam. Con el pim, 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 pim.
On weekend evenings, a tuna, that is to say a group of university students from some Spanish university, would arrive, swashbuckling in black capes bedecked with ribbons and carrying instruments, and they would serenade the diners with an assortment of traditional university songs for tips and maybe a drink. If I was lucky, I would meet up with my friend Sam Floyd, and we'd snag a booth, and I'd tag along while he and others had dinner with James Baldwin, who frequently visited. And those others would be Maya Angelou, Paul Marshall, occasionally Nina Simone. Those were heady times. At this end of Greenwich Avenue, I discovered an antiquarian bookstore and would now be rich if I'd invested in the first editions that were for sale. There was an auction house as well, and there I learned to bid and tested my skills against Bayard Rustin, who was a neighborhood denizen. This side of the village had a more international air to it. There was a butcher shop on the corner of my street that was so picturesque that it would occasionally close. But then lights could be seen through the windows as commercials and movies were filmed in its old-style decor. On normal days, a butcher cut meat to order on a venerable butcher block, and the butcher's wife sold pâtés and charcuteries that tasted of France. On the narrow triangle where Greenwich and West 13th meet in a point, a restaurant called Bruxelles arrived and celebrated the food of Belgium. At its bar, I learned to drink beer with names like Duval and Mort Subite, although how I had the courage to try something called Subtle Death was beyond me.
L'astro d'argento, l'acci dell'onda, prospero il vento.
Italian food changed in those years, and for a while, the king of West Village Italian food was a man known as Alfredo Viazzi. At one point, he had three restaurants in that neighborhood. He transformed the way I thought of food from the boot. It was no longer simply the choice between red sauce vibrancy of the South and the butter-based dishes of the North, but light foods, an array of salads and delicious cheeses, all eaten with wonderful crusty bread. Yes, I had discovered Zito's bakery and the cheese stores nearby. There was just something about Alfredo's places that allowed for an experience that harked more to Europe than to bustle and hustle of the rest of the city. They were spots to sit and savor, to indulge in conversation with friends about cabbages and kings and much, much more. They somehow summed up the times and the friendships of that period. If Alfredo's places were spots to sit and commune with friends, they harked back to a village tradition that was slowly dying out, even when I arrived. The coffee houses. Coffee houses used to dot the landscape, another testimonial to the area's Italian heritage. The Greenwich Village Cookbook, a marvelous compendium of over 400 recipes from village restaurants, was published in 1969, and a perusal of its pages is like a trip down memory lane as author Vivian Kramer presents 75 village restaurants. She also shares a wonderful preserved in amber memorial to some of the village coffee houses. Then she wrote, "Like the whooping crane, the coffee house is becoming a rare breed, slowly losing out to modern society to the chagrin of many. The heart of the problem is money. The rents in Greenwich Village today, that's 1969, demand enterprises with steady turnover of merchandise. Coffee houses were invented for a different time, a different climate, another culture. Still, some survive, selling soft beverages of all types, pastries, sometimes snacks and sandwiches, even meals and alcohol in a few instances, to a wide range of patrons. Flower people, college professors, curious out-of-towners, partygoers, iconoclasts, artists, students, swingers, and other village types. For those not familiar with the interesting breed of enterprise, coffee houses share a number of characteristics. They are informal, some devotees carrying that to a fault in their appearance. They permit people to loll away the time, since you can settle for a cappuccino or an espresso and hang around as long as you like. This before Starbucks. Prices per item may seem high to the uninitiated, but in truth, you are buying time, along with ice cream, pastry, or coffee. Coffee house owners work very long hours, probably due to economic necessity, and in fact, many of their best customers are night people who don't wake up until after midnight. The atmosphere of the coffee houses varies with the temperament of the owner. Philip Cardesi, then owner of Café Borgia, who operates Café Borgia, is very much taken with that important Italian family and claims to be distantly related to the Borgias. He sees them as patrons of the arts and has tried to capture that theme and other aspects of the Renaissance in paintings and in wall decorations. But the ultimate in Italian coffee shops has to be Café Reggio, with its tiny round wooden marble tables, its ice cream parlor look, its pastries all on display and large espresso machine, the absence of a kitchen, and moderate prices. The customers, along with the help and the owners, are all Italian, and they all speak the mother tongue and feel very much at home, as well they should. Many of the customers can just be described as neighborhood regulars, and to pass the time, they might well savor a lemon ice arlecchino or solely sip an egg cream zabaglione. So despite the laws of economics, some coffee houses find a way to survive, but it is not easy. Even the most famous of them falter. At the very heart of Greenwich Village, Bohemia, in 1969, the Café Figaro was probably the best known of the coffee dispensaries. But then, it turned off the espresso machine for good. As a Figaro employee noted, you can't run a business on people who stay 4 hours on one cup of coffee. So, she exhorts us in 1969, why not order that second cup of cappuccino? The cappuccino is made with real espresso in an espresso machine, and the milk is steamed in a jet attachment that puffs it up properly. And that extra purchase may help keep an interesting institution alive a little bit longer. Well, many have indeed gone, victims of Times and Starbucks, but Borgia, too, lives on at Prince Street in Soho, and Café Reggio remains a monument to the village past.
Je vous parle d'un temps que les moins de 20 ans ne peuvent pas connaître. Montmartre en ce temps-là accrochait ses lilas jusque sous nos fenêtres et si l'humble garni qui nous servait de nid ne payait pas de
Julia Greco and others from France had their bohemian life in Saint-Germain-des-Prés or Montmartre. But as with everything, the places of our prime jeunesse are wild and sometimes misspent youth. Okay. Julia Greco and others from France have had their bohemian lives in Montmartre or Saint-Germain-des-Prés as they were in the past. But as with everything, the places of our prime jeunesse are wild and sometimes misspent youths evolve. Times change. Things and people move on. A few weeks ago, some of the urban kin that I connected with in those years got together with me in the village. We sipped the red wine of our youth and shared reminiscences about restaurants past and times past, and marveled at how far we'd come and at the collections of barnacles on the bows of our ships of our lives. Then we all got up, knees creaking but still kicking, and headed off with our usual panache to the Waverly Inn to share another meal. We had survived, as had the Waverly Inn, each in its own way, testimonials to the durability of the human spirit and the ever-changing excitement of the village and its residents. So until next time,